Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's no secret by now that opioid painkillers can be highly addictive and that these legal medicines have played a role in New Hampshire's broader heroin and opioid crisis. And so state officials and the medical community have been trying to come up with new guidelines for physicians and other health providers for prescribing these. A bill in the legislature tells the state's various boards of medicine and other governing bodies that they need to update their practices in light of the drug epidemic. And last week, the New Hampshire Board of Medicine adopted new guidelines attempting to meet a middle ground between concerns about overprescribing and the legitimate needs of patients who suffer from a lot of pain. Today in The Exchange, how to prescribe opioids in an age of addiction. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests for the hour with me in studio. Representative Cindy Rosenwald, Democratic State Rep from Nashua. She's lead sponsor of a bill requiring various boards to adopt rules for prescribing controlled drugs. And Representative Rosenwald, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio, Dr. David Strang, chairman of the New Hampshire Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Advisory Council and an emergency physician and partner in Central New Hampshire ER Associates. And Dr. Strang, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
And joining us by phone, Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's chief medical officer at Phoenix House, a nonprofit drug and alcohol rehabilitation organization. He's also executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing and a senior scientist at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. And Dr. Kolodny, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Dr. Gil Fanciullo, director of the Pain Management Center at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and professor of anesthesiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. And Dr. Fanciullo, good to have you, too. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, we're going to use the term opioids a lot this hour. So, Dr. Strang, let's just start with you. What is an opioid?
Opioids are substances that come from opium, which is derived from the poppy plant. There are naturally occurring opioids like codeine, for example, which most people have heard of. And then there are synthetic opioids like fentanyl or Demerol. Most people know these substances as narcotics. Narcotics is actually more a term that we run into in the law enforcement world. The proper medical term, though, is opiates or opioids. And these are most commonly used for controlling pain, severe pain. But as we're going to be discussing in the next hour, they've become a real problem in our general society, not just in New Hampshire, not just in New England, but all over the United States.
Well, and tie heroin into that group, Dr. Strang.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Heroin also comes from the poppy plant. It's actually something that was available as a pharmaceutical back in the early 1900s.
Really?
You could actually buy that in a pharmacy for pain control. That's a very interesting part of medical history. But then rapidly we realized that it was extremely addicting and that was taken off the market. But it's available now for non-medical use, and unfortunately it's become a very big problem in the United States because it's become very, very inexpensive. And sadly, we're seeing a lot of people who become addicted to prescription opiates, which are very expensive comparatively. And when people can't afford that, they turn to heroin and further their addiction.
And one more background question for you, please, Dr. Strang. When did we see this newer class of opioid painkillers coming onto the market. You know, Percocet, OxyContin, those are the ones that often come to mind. And what need were they trying to fill?
Well, Percocet and some of the shorter-acting medicines like Vicodin have been available for decades. But I want to say in the mid-1990s, we started seeing longer-acting versions like OxyContin. I think that's one of the ones that people have probably heard about more than anything else. And it was really designed for people who have long-term pain, cancer-related pain, for example, to achieve relief without having to take a pill every 4 or 5 hours. You could take a pill once or twice a day and be reasonably comfortable from your pain. However, the people who abuse medications like this found very quickly you could grind this up and get all of the medication available immediately by either swallowing it or snorting it or smoking it. And when those medicines became used more widely, that's when we really started to see this problem take off.
Well, and you've written a lot about this, Dr. Kolodny. I'd love your thoughts there, too. When things started to go south, if I could put it that way.
Sure. I appreciate the question. It was with the introduction of OxyContin that its manufacturer launched a multifaceted campaign designed to get the medical community to feel more comfortable with opioids as a class of drug. In the early 90s, many in the medical community knew better than to treat common chronic conditions like low back pain or chronic headache or fibromyalgia. We knew better than to use a highly addictive drug for these common conditions. We knew that if you exposed a patient to a highly addictive drug long-term, many patients would get addicted. And we understood that because opioids, patients develop a tolerance, we knew that to continue to get pain relief, many patients would need to have the dose go higher and higher. And we knew that if patients were taking opioids for a while, physiological dependence would set in, making it difficult to discontinue use. So the medical community understood that opioids were appropriate drugs for end-of-life care. We understood that they were appropriate for a few days after major surgery, for example, but we weren't using them widely for these common conditions. Purdue launched a campaign where they reframed these very good reasons for being cautious with opioids as barriers to compassionate pain care. The medical community began to hear that we had been allowing patients to suffer needlessly because of an overblown fear of addiction. Doctors began to be taught that the risk of addiction was much less than 1%, and that the compassionate way to treat just about any complaint of pain was with an opioid. And as the prescribing began to take off in response to this campaign, it led to an epidemic of addiction and overdose deaths. And one last point I just want to add on to something that Dr. Strang mentioned. Heroin is very closely related to hydrocodone and oxycodone, two of the most commonly prescribed opioids. A study was done at Columbia University where they allowed heroin users to self-administer different opioids and rate which they liked the best. The oxycodone actually beat out the heroin, but for the most part, an experienced heroin user can't tell one from the other. When we talk about drugs like oxycodone and hydrocodone, these are drugs that produce effects that are identical to the effects produced by heroin. These are essentially heroin pills.
Well, and Dr. Kolodny, when you say Purdue, that's the manufacturer, not Purdue University.
That's correct. And I will say other opioid manufacturers became involved in the campaign to encourage prescribing. And it wasn't just the drug company telling doctors to prescribe OxyContin or prescribe opioids. It was a multifaceted campaign. And many of the people involved in this campaign truly fell for it. They truly believed we were allowing patients to suffer needlessly because of an overblown fear of addiction. Opioids are a gift from Mother Nature, and we should be more compassionate in our treatment of pain. So it wasn't just the drug company paying doctors to teach this. Many people who were teaching it truly believed it.
People genuinely believed that they were helping their patients, some of whom were suffering deeply. And Dr. Fanciullo, I should bring you in here again, director of the Pain Management Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Dr. Kolodny and I think and Dr. Strang, and I mean, I think every time one of the participants on your show, you know, make one sentence, that it brings up an opportunity for a whole string of discussions. I totally agree with the Purdue Pharma campaign aspect of creating this problem, and I also believe that doctors innocently really went about prescribing opioids because their desire was always just to try to help their patients, and they truly believed that for the most part they could help relieve pain by using these drugs, and they truly believed for the most part that the risk was relatively small. You know, you talked about, Laura, when did this become an issue? It became an issue, really, with OxyContin in the mid-90s, but I can remember that there was a front-page cover on the New York Times Magazine section that said the OxyContin epidemic, and had a picture of a drug addict, and that was published in the year 2000. And so here it is, 2016, 16 years after we knew that there was an epidemic, and finally it seems like people are having an increased awareness of the extent of this problem, and perhaps the fact that many physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs were misled by the data that was published, almost always sponsored by pharmaceutical companies.
Well, and that's exactly what I wanted to ask you, Representative Rosenwald. We have been talking about this overdose and addiction problem for some time now. I remember in the early 2000s doing programs on the abuse of perfectly legal painkillers. A lot of people made this link between easy access to opioids and the current drug crisis. Why has it taken us until 2016 to finally tighten up in terms of our prescribing rules?
That's a great question. I think the fact is, from my perspective, we are in a huge public health crisis in New Hampshire because of the number of people who are addicted to prescription and non-prescription opioids. We know that 80% at least of heroin users begin by taking OxyContin or some other prescribed opioid. Those opioids might not be prescribed for them. They're stealing it out of a friend's medicine cabinet. They're buying it from a friend. They're finding it some way. And in the last 2 years, the number of our drug overdose deaths in New Hampshire has doubled. Last year, we lost 431 people, more than one every day. And we have information on the amount of legally prescribed opioids in New Hampshire that is just staggering. We have in 3 months 13 million doses of the Schedule II opioids, the strongest ones, dispensed in our tiny state.
A state of 1.3 million people.
10 doses.
How much pain can we possibly have?
10 doses for every person in this state.
But why now? I mean, again, we've been talking about this for a long time. Why did it take us so long to get to this point where we're finally talking about, you know, yeah, Board of Medicine, maybe you need to tighten up a little bit on those prescribing rules?
Well, I don't think it's only our state. Really, there was not national guidance until quite recently. In 2013, the CDC issued a black box warning, or was it the FDA? I'm not sure. I'll be corrected by one of the doctors on extended release OxyContin. That's their strongest warning. But it was only a couple of weeks ago that same black box warning was issued for immediate release OxyContin. So we were just not getting the national guidance either until very recently.
Dr. Kolodny, what do you think? Why has it taken so long?
I think that as the epidemic began, we heard from Dr. Fanciullo that even in 2000, there were media reports of addiction and overdose death, particularly from Appalachia, New England. From the very beginning of the epidemic, it was framed for policymakers in a way in which they were being led to believe that all of the bad stuff we were hearing about, overdoses, addiction, that was the drug abusers, and that these drugs were helping millions of people with pain. And what policymakers kept hearing is that we have two problems in America, a problem of the drug abusers and a problem of millions of people with pain who need good access to these medications. And the message there was that all of the harms were limited to the so-called drug abusers, and let's not punish the pain patients because of their bad behavior. It was as if we have a subset of our population that just wants to use drugs to get high off of them, and if we took away the painkillers, they'd be sniffing glue. That's the drug abusers. They didn't want policymakers to understand that patients were being harmed by these medications. That actually, over the past decade, millions of pain patients have become addicted. Thousands have lost their lives. And when you look at people who are dying of prescription overdoses, most appear to be people receiving legitimate prescriptions for a pain problem. And not only are these medications highly addictive and unsafe for many patients with pain, but we also now understand that they don't work well when taken long term. They can even make pain worse. But I'd say for the first 15 years of this epidemic, we kept hearing that we needed to focus on the teenagers getting into grandma's medicine chest. Let's stop the non-medical use, but let's not do anything that might decrease doctors prescribing these drugs. And that message is no longer beginning to fly. We heard from the CDC about 3 weeks ago. They issued a new guideline for the primary care community on use of opioids, and they issued it along with an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine to make clear, and this is the first time we're really hearing from the federal government, they wanted to make very clear to the medical community that the widespread routine practice of treating common conditions with long-term opioids is inappropriate, that we're harming patients and fueling an addiction epidemic. But I'd say we've done very little because the problem was not framed the proper way.
Well, and I saw that CDC recommendation. I definitely want to ask all of you about it and a lot more questions. But let's go to our listeners as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Mike is in Hillsboro. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling in. You're on the exchange. Mike, are you there? Good morning. Okay, Mike, I hope you call back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Shirley's in Nashua. Hi, Shirley. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a person that has had to take OxyContin for a number of years off and on because I had an undiagnosed condition for a while, and it turned out to be my pancreas. And it was due to a birth defect, and I had my pancreas removed. But during all that time, the only pain relief I could get was on OxyContin. And I'm concerned that people like me, where that's the only thing that really worked, and I had weaned off that medicine many times before when I'd had it for short periods of time. So clearly, I'm a responsible person using it. I've had trouble getting my prescriptions filled at the pharmacy, and some of the new rules that they're suggesting are going to make it extremely difficult for people like me to get our prescriptions filled.
Well, and Shirley, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your struggling. And second of all, I'm glad you called because, Dr. Strang, we've heard a lot of stories like Shirley's reported, people who have serious long-term pain, and they're worried that this is going to cut back something that they feel helps them function in life.
Well, if I think one of the things that I'd like to reassure Shirley about is that efforts to properly prescribe are really geared towards making sure that we're not over-medicating patients. One of the things that the Prescription Monitoring Program, and I serve as the chair of the advisory council for that body, does is it gathers the prescription data from all of the state's pharmacies into one usable medical record so that before I write a prescription for oxycodone or before Shirley's doctor writes her a prescription for OxyContin, they can consult this database to make sure that they're not duplicating the prescription efforts of one, two, five other physicians and potentially providing Shirley or another patient with a fatal overdose of medication.
So she shouldn't worry that she will lose access to these medications.
Correct, and I don't think that the Board of Medicine rules that they adopted last week are going to do anything to accomplish that either.
Okay, Shirley, thank you for calling in, and we'll take a lot more of your calls in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, prescribing opioids in an age of addiction. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here in New Hampshire, state lawmakers, doctors, and others in the medical profession have been hammering out new guidelines for prescribing these drugs to tackle the issue of overuse and hopefully alleviate the addiction crisis. We're finding out the latest. We're looking at how New Hampshire's approach might compare to other states. And we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dr. Fantullo, I did want to hear from you, too, on our caller, Shirley, who says she has a lot of pain. She's had problems with her pancreas. She's worried that as the Board of Medicine and state lawmakers tighten up, she won't have access to pain relief. And I wonder what you think, Dr. Fantullo.
Sure. So I do believe that there are a subset of the patients that we're treating with opioids right now who truly benefit from the use of these drugs long term. And this is controversial in the medical community right now, but it is my belief that some of my patients actually benefit from the use of these drugs, and it might be as high as a third of the patients that I take care of. I think that the Board of Medicine has the best interest of the patients and the citizens in the state of New Hampshire really at heart. And I think that the recommendations that they've made, even though it's going to create some challenges for providers to comply with all of their recommendations, are really consistent just with best care. And I think that, you know, a prudent physician or nurse practitioner or PA who's treating patients with opioids really should have been doing all along and really should do the things that the Board of Medicine has recommended. I don't think there's anything on there, anything in these recommendations that's onerous, inappropriate, et cetera.
So you're saying, Dr. Fantullo, that the Board of Medicine is just trying to reduce the number of pills given out, and Representative Rosenwald gave us some astonishing numbers, but not taking it away from people who legitimately need it.
That's correct, and it even goes further than that. It's what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify people who suffer from the disease addiction, and that's a horrible disease, and it's a treatable disease. And so I think that for us to continue to prescribe opioids to somebody under the guise of treating pain, whose primary disease is really addiction, is an awful mistake. If we can identify people who suffer from the disease addiction and get them into treatment, we can change their lives.
Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And Mike is back with us from Hillsboro. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I'm an M. LADAC, and I just wanted to make a couple of points.
And M. LADAC is, remind us, Mike.
A master's level alcohol drug counselor. Here working in community health here in New Hampshire. I was at a training the other day for use of naloxone or Narcan, and the trainer, which was done under the auspices of public health, pointed out that New Hampshire had been targeted by the big drug cartels. He mentioned El Chapo by name because of our liberal prescribing policies and our lack of emphasis on prevention and treatment. He said, like any good big business, big illicit drug does research and marketing, and saw New Hampshire as a state where these policies made it rife for the sale of their product. And I really think the medical establishment, under the influence of big pharma, has not done a good job in policing themselves on these prescribing practices. I think it is appropriate that the legislature step in with decisive steps to regulate this process.
Well, Mike, thanks for calling in. And you know, Representative Rosenwald, it did come up a couple months ago that New Hampshire is one of the top states, maybe top five or top three, when it comes to our struggles with this. So does Mike have a point there?
I think Mike has a point. Certainly, we have had, essentially until last week when the Board of Medicine adopted prescribing rules, we have not had any rules among the seven boards whose licensees are allowed to prescribe controlled substances. We've had some emergency rules that are in place for 6 months, but other states have been in a similar situation. We were very late to implement the prescription drug monitoring program. And I first met Dr. Strang, I think, 11 or 12 years ago as he was trying to get the legislature to enact this program. We were the 49th state. We are now working to make sure that our prescribers use the prescription drug monitoring program before they prescribe. It's been voluntary. It's going to become more mandatory.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty big charge, Dr. Strang, that Mike levels, that New Hampshire's lax rules and easy access made us a perfect target. What do you think?
Well, we were the 49th of 50 states to adopt a PMP, or prescription monitoring program. And everywhere else in the country where you had an island state, so we were surrounded by other states and even a Canadian province to the north that had PMPs, and everywhere else that's been duplicated in the country, guess where all the abuse and attempts to divert drugs shift to? So we were a particular target up here in the Northeast, and then in the last several years, even as we have set up and started running our PMP, heroin prices have come down drastically. So it's a very inexpensive alternative to prescription opiate medications if you're addicted and need to get high. And that's why we're seeing such a surge in heroin use up here in New England.
Wow. Well, Mike, thank you for the call. And let's take Jesse in Pembroke. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Morning. Good. Thanks.
Well, a couple things that I think are going to get left out of the conversation oftentimes. First being that 95% of the world's heroin comes out of Afghanistan, U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. And there's been, I mean, if you look at the correlation overlay, the rise in heroin addiction is directly, the timeline is directly coincides with U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Additionally, I have a friend who works for the, I believe it's either Purdue or Amphastar, and basically he's telling me, well, we make good drugs too. Like in addition to Oxycontin, we also make Narcan. And that when he told me that, I'm like, wait, so you guys make the problem and you make the solution?
You know, Jesse, someone else raised this on the air a couple weeks ago. Dr. Kalani, do you want to address that? And then I've got another question for all of you about those new CDC pain guidelines. But go ahead, Dr. Kalani.
Sure. On the issue of our heroin supply, I believe most of our heroin is coming in through Mexico. It's not grown in Afghanistan. The opium is grown in Mexico. The epidemic has been caused by overexposing our population to prescription opioids. We have basically two age groups that have become opioid addicted over the past 15, 20 years, an older group and a younger group. The younger group, people in their 20s and 30s, when they get addicted, whether their addiction was caused by either medical use or recreational use, when they get addicted, they have a very hard time maintaining their opioid supply visiting doctors. Doctors and dentists don't mind giving young people pills, but they don't want to give a large quantity on a monthly basis to a healthy-looking 25-year-old, unless maybe the doctor's a drug dealer. So that group has been winding up on the black market, and as we heard earlier, the pills are more expensive on the black market, so they switch. But we also have an older group, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who are developing opioid addiction almost entirely through medical treatment for acute pain, which becomes a chronic pain problem after they've been put on opioids, or for a chronic pain problem. That older group hasn't been switching to heroin. That older group, when they get addicted, even when their own primary care doctor begins to get uncomfortable, maybe the patient's coming in early, asking for higher doses, often the primary care doctor doesn't want to label the patient with a stigmatized diagnosis of addiction, might not even know where to send the patient for addiction treatment. Since the patient is saying they're taking extra pills because of their pain, they get referred to pain management. And if the patient is lucky, they'll see a doctor like Dr. Fanciullo, who's really going to try and help that patient and maybe even get the dose of the opioid down or try to get the patient off or find other strategies to help the patient with their pain. But there are also many pain management doctors who just continue the patient on an opioid or increase the dose. And what's not well known and not reported on very much is that the overdose death rate is actually higher in the older group that's getting pills more easily from doctors than it is in the younger group that's been switching to heroin. The age group with the highest rate of opioid overdose in the United States is 45 to 54 years old.
Wow. Okay, see, I didn't realize that. That's something that you just don't, you know, it doesn't fit with the image that we have of drug addiction and drug overdose. Jesse, thank you for the call. And since you mentioned pain management, Dr. Kolodny, I did want to tackle that with all of you. And to you first, Dr. Fanciullo, as Dr. Kolodny mentioned earlier, the CDC has new guidelines on pain, telling doctors maybe you shouldn't go to opioids first. Just real broadly, what is the CDC saying? And then I'd love to ask you all about it.
Thank you, Laura. I think actually you should direct that question towards somebody else because, quite frankly, I'm not intimately familiar with the CDC recommendations. I can talk about the New Hampshire recommendations, you know, at length, but I really can't quote the CDC recommendations.
Go ahead and give us that first, and then we'll jump into the CDC. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Fanciullo.
Sure. So I think what the New Hampshire legislature has done is that they're trying to make it safer for our patients. So some of the things that they're requiring is, for example, that we do what's called a risk stratification. And they're specifying that we use specific tools. There's a tool, for example, called the opioid risk tool, which will tell us if a patient who's presenting in our office is a low-risk patient, a moderate-risk patient, or a high-risk patient. And so that's going to help doctors right off the bat. They're using an instrument. They don't really have to have the highly skilled ability to make that assessment themselves. They need to access the prescription drug monitoring program database, as Dr. Strang had suggested, before they prescribe opioids, and they have to do it at least twice a year. They have to check a urine toxicology specimen on their patients. We published some data a number of years ago that showed that you could not rely on patients. You can't just say to them, are you using other drugs? Because people who suffer from the disease addiction will give you misinformation. So if you do a urine toxicology specimen and you find heroin in the urine, well, then the solution is relatively easy. They need treatment for addiction. We need to talk about goals of treatment. So it used to be that we could just have a patient come into the office and say, well, you have pain. I'm going to give you this drug. We'll reduce your pain. Nowadays, we're trying to be a lot more specific about that. What exactly do you hope to accomplish? What does the patient hope to accomplish by the use of this drug? Do they want to go back to work? Do they want to go to the gym three times a week? Do they want to be able to play with their grandchildren? We need to articulate specifically what the goals of treatment are so that we can determine whether or not we're actually achieving something. So that when we see the patient back in 3 months, we can say, did we help this patient or did we not help this patient? And the last thing that they're requiring, which I think is really wise and prudent, is that the patients need to see the doctors every 4 months at a minimum. You can't just see a patient once a year, prescribe opioids for a whole year from them by telephone, and not see them back to assess them regularly. And so there was a lot of discussion about that every 4 months, or should it be every 3 months, or should it be every month. But I think every 4 months is a very reasonable compromise. So those are all the things that the state's now requiring.
So, Dr. Fanciullo, it sounds like you are okay with the direction that the Board of Medicine is going here in New Hampshire.
I am. And you know, we had the discussion a little bit earlier, Laura, about why it don't want to blame anybody, but why it took so long for the legislature to get involved. And I think part of the reason for that is that organized medicine does not want the legislature to tell them how to practice medicine.
Right. We did hear that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of resistance from organized medicine to having the legislature involved. And everybody hoped that doctors were just going to, you know, see the light and realize what was going on and change their practices, but it just hasn't happened. And so I think it's totally appropriate, and I don't think the timing is bad that the legislature gets involved in the state of New Hampshire.
Well, and Dr. Kolodny, you've looked at how other states have tackled this. Who do you think is doing a really good job when it comes to statewide rules and practices around prescribing opioids? And how might New Hampshire compare? I'm not sure if you want to go there or not, but I'll give you the opportunity.
I think that Massachusetts recently passed a law limiting the quantity of pills that can be prescribed, or the duration of days that a patient can be prescribed opioids for a first-time prescription for an acute pain problem. And I think the governor initially wanted 3 days. There was a compromise with the medical society of 7 days for a first-time prescription. I think that the focus on trying to reduce the quantity of pills in a first-time prescription, I think, makes sense. The states that have been very effective in this problem have been states that have passed laws mandating that their doctors use that PDMP before they write a prescription. That's been very helpful, and it's great to see this coming to New Hampshire. But New York, Tennessee, and Kentucky mandated that their doctors use the database. And this was an intervention resisted by the medical community. The state medical societies were opposed to laws being passed that would require them to use that database. But that's also been very helpful. I think that New Hampshire is on the right track. I like much of what Dr. Fanciullo just described. There's one item that concerns me a little bit, which is the idea that we can screen patients in advance and figure out who's low risk, medium risk, or high risk for having a problem with opioids. And I guess the idea would be that if a patient doesn't have any personal or family history of a drug or an alcohol problem or mental health history, that we don't have to worry so much about those patients. And it is true that some patients can be higher risk for getting into trouble with opioids, but there really is no such thing as low risk. Opioids are not like alcohol. With alcohol, 90% of our population can be repeatedly exposed to alcohol and doesn't develop an alcohol problem. It's about 10% that gets into trouble. And when you look at that group, you see that alcohol problems do tend to run in run in families. Opioids, however, are much more addictive. With repeated exposure to an opioid, just about anybody can get addicted. Opioids are more like nicotine, where most people who smoke cigarettes wind up getting addicted. It's difficult to use tobacco on a regular basis and not get hooked. With the highly addictive drugs, it's the inherent addictive property of the drug that plays a more important role in addiction than patient characteristics. But overall, I think New Hampshire is on the right track.
Well, and a question for you, I think, Dr. Strang, again, since you're an emergency room doc, I've looked at the Board of Medicine proposal and the rules, and a lot of them seem to assume this sort of cozy doctor-patient relationship where you've got good insurance and you can come in every 3 months and check in and you have easy access. You're in an ER situation, so I wonder how these rules affect you, where you're sort of making very quick decisions for someone who you've never seen before.
Well, a lot of the rules that the Board of Medicine was focusing on were really geared towards the treatment of chronic pain, which is not what we do in the emergency department. We deal with acute pain. You come in with a broken wrist or a kidney stone. Those are short-term, self-limited illnesses. So a lot of what the Board of Medicine has focused on thus far has really dealt with chronic pain. Unfortunately, they sort of left open how we treat and address acute pain. And I think we still need to utilize the prescription monitoring program when we're treating acute pain, because we have a lot of patients who are addicted or who are diverting for sale on the street who come in feigning an illness, feigning an injury in order to obtain a prescription for opiate medication. And Representative Rosenwald's bill actually addresses that acute pain gap. So I think this is going to be a multifaceted approach between what the Board of Medicine is doing and what the legislature is doing in order to get us towards a better position where we're better equipped to address this problem.
All right. I have a lot more questions for all of you, and we will continue taking your calls, your comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and coming up, a lot more emails and calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with lawmakers and doctors about how best to handle opioid prescribing, how to avoid adding to the addiction problem while still taking care of people suffering from pain. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, back to our listeners. Rob's joining us from Concord. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to ask your panel to comment on my concern that the rhetoric and the talk about addiction may make people at the end of life, both patients and their clinicians, hesitant to either prescribe or accept opiates when they can be very helpful and the risk of addiction is extremely low.
Do you want to jump in on that, Dr. Strang? Thank you, Rob, for the call.
Absolutely. The recently adopted rules by the Board of Medicine specifically exclude the prescribing of opiate medication for end-of-life care or for cancer-related pain. So specifically, they wanted to make sure that that class of patient had access to opiate medications in order to achieve adequate control of pain, particularly at the end of life.
Here's some emails I want to share with all of you. Here's one from Peter in Durham who says, links between addiction and opioid prescriptions are usually discussed qualitatively or on a case-by-case basis. Do we have data from heroin addicts indicating what proportion of them became addicted through prescription medication? I think, Representative Rosenwald, you talked about that earlier, but go ahead. And Peter, thank you for the email.
We do, and it feels kind of weird being the person who brings up the New England Journal of Medicine. Crowd,
as the only non-doctor on the panel.
I have read a recent review article which says, it quotes studies that have ranged from 25% to up to 86%. I think the consensus appears to be that it's at least 80% of heroin users get their start with prescription opioids, whether they're legally obtained or illegally obtained.
Wow. Dr. Kolodny, does that line up with what you've studied?
Yeah, well, we have among people who are opioid addicted and are heroin users today, there is an older group of people who became addicted to heroin in the 1970s. These are mostly in inner city communities. They're men, usually African American or Latino, who did begin with heroin. But if you're looking at the population of people who've become opioid addicted over the past 20 years, well, one thing is that they're almost entirely white. But that group, I think it's over 90% that began with the use of prescription opioids.
Here's an email from Sue in Nashua to that point. She says, I feel that the newly focused attention to this epidemic is primarily due to the fact that until it was affecting middle and upper class white families, the government turned a blind eye. They felt that drugs and addiction only affected the poor, non-white population in New Hampshire. Sue says, now that it's clear more working class families have addiction issues, possibly in their families, they're finally taking notice. What do you think about that, Dr. Strang?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that
just
again?
The idea that, you know, we're paying attention because it's not just affecting poor people or minority folks.
Well,
is that fair criticism or not?
I think that Dr. Kolodny's comments were correct. Back in the 1960s and 70s, the people who became addicted to heroin started with heroin. More recently, we clearly have seen a change to people who are starting off with prescription opiate medications, and then when those become unaffordable, they turn to heroin. It's
kind of turned the whole image on its head, whether or not that image was ever correct.
It has, and Representative Rosenwald alluded to this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, excuse me, where they talked about there was some disagreement as to whether people were starting with opiate medications in the prescription form nowadays. My personal experience as an emergency physician practicing for 27 years is that most of the addicts that we're seeing nowadays are starting with prescription medications and then being switched over to heroin because it's cheaper and more available.
Let's take another call. This is Nancy in Wolfboro. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to give a different perspective, which is when my brother was very ill in the hospital and really needed pain medication for open heart surgery, I sort of was guilt tripping him about, you know, concerned about becoming addicted. And the nurses said to me, you can't heal when you're in pain. And after he died, I felt very terrible that I had done that. And I think that it's important that families hear the message that when you need the painkillers, you really need them and that you deal with the addiction after. So I'm worried about people who really need painkillers being stigmatized.
Thank you, Nancy, for the call. And by the way, I'm sorry to hear about your brother. And, you know, Dr. Fanciullo, what do you think that your body can't heal if it's battling pain?
I think there's truth to that. I mean, I think we know that people who suffer from chronic pain have a shorter life expectancy than people who don't suffer from chronic pain. And we know that untreated chronic pain results in the production of a lot of harmful substances in our bodies that prevent us from healing. And so I think your caller's message is a very valid message. A person that's in the hospital, a person who's had open heart surgery, a person that has a hip replacement, you know, a person that has cancer, you know, these are people who need to take opioids, and the benefits of using opioids probably outweighs the risks most of the time in that population of patients. And the chronic pain population is just an entirely different population.
Nancy, thank you for the call. And let's go next to David in Concord. David, you're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions and or comments. One, when I have, before I started taking opioids, as prescribed by my doctor, for neck pain, chronic neck pain, I was taking 8 to 12 Excedrin a day just to get to keep from having so many headaches. So how do you, when you take somebody off opioids, how do you keep them from switching back to what in some cases can be a more dangerous alternative over-the-counter because there's less control, if you will? Whereas when I go to get a prescription for my opioids, my doctor says, okay, this is something you can have. You take one, you know, every 6 hours. But if I had an addictive nature, what if I were to go back to taking that many Excedrins, and I haven't done it for years because they've helped with the opioids, but if they were to say, okay, you can't take them anymore, you're shut off, then what keeps me from going to the local pharmacy and buying, you know, big bottles of Excedrin?
Sure.
And they're not going to give you the what supposedly opioids give you, but they did help me to function.
And yet we do hear, David, I'm glad you called. This is a very important point. And I'll turn to you first, Dr. Kolodny, but want to hear from others. You know, the non-opioids, they have problems too. Tylenol or acetaminophen broadly can cause liver damage. Motrin and its subsets can cause stomach problems. I mean, the non-opioid painkillers aren't all they're chucked up to be either. David, thank you so much for the call. What do you think, Dr. Kolodny?
Well, it's true that medicines like Tylenol and Advil, Advil is ibuprofen or an NSAID, that those medicines are not without their own side effects. But they are safer than opioids. They're much safer than opioids. They're sold over the counter for that reason, because they are safer. In fact, in the effort to convince the medical community to prescribe opioids more aggressively, the risks of drugs like Advil were exaggerated. One of the things the medical community began to hear was that 16,000 people were dying every year from gastrointestinal bleeds caused by Advil. And drugs like Advil, and that turned out to be totally not true. In fact, the total number of Americans who die from gastrointestinal bleeding from all causes, let alone induced by NSAIDs, is less than 3,000.
So the risks have been exaggerated, Dr. Kolodny.
They were exaggerated. So I do think that they do have risk, these medicines, and we shouldn't take them too lightly. But they're safer than opioids, and we're underutilizing them. In the United States, when we take out wisdom teeth from teenagers, just about every teenager is prescribed Vicodin, hydrocodone, again, essentially a heroin pill, often given 10, 20, 30, 40 pills. In other countries in Western Europe, teenagers, when their wisdom teeth come out, are given drugs like Advil. And there have been studies that have shown that Advil, especially when Advil is combined with Tylenol, because they can be mixed since they work differently, that Advil plus Tylenol can be as effective, if not more effective, for some types of acute pain than 10 milligrams of morphine. So I think we're actually underutilizing those options. And as the prescribing of opioids began to explode, we saw decreases in the use of safer analgesics. One of the messages from the CDC is that we should be using non-opioid pain medicines first. We should try those options first, and try non-pharmacologic options first for chronic pain.
You know, it's interesting you mention wisdom teeth. Representative Rosenwald, I know you want to jump in. A friend of mine's daughter just got her wisdom teeth out last week, and she was shocked in this era of supposedly hyper concern about opioids that no one even suggested to her daughter, try Tylenol, try Motrin. They just sent her home with the opioids and said, you know, good luck. She was kind of stunned by that. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to reassure David that there's nothing in the Board of Medicine rules or in the bill that is mine that actually leads physicians to take people off chronic opioid treatment. What it, I think, hopes to do in both cases is to perhaps lead doctors to start fewer people on chronic opioid treatment. So just wanted to reassure him.
Well, and David, I'm glad you called because it gets us into this area of, okay, if you've got really bad pain, you're worried about opioid addiction, what else do you do? And Dr. Chladni mentioned that the CDC recommends doctors more often look at some of these other alternatives, including just plain old, you know, Motrin, Tylenol, whatever. Dr. Fanciullo, the CDC and others have also recommended physicians look at, you know, physical therapy, chiropractic care, acupuncture, you know, other alternatives for dealing with pain. But these are often poorly covered or not covered at all by insurance. So I just wonder how you as a physician navigate that. You think someone might benefit from chiropractic care or they might benefit from physical therapy, but, you know, it's $50 a visit.
Right. I mean, this is an enormous problem with our health insurers dictating how we treat patients. You know, our health insurers are happy to pay $20,000 for a spinal fusion, but they don't want to pay $50 for physical therapy. My general approach, so a couple things, Laura, that I've been thinking about as I've been listening to the other conversations. First of all, the use of other medications. I have looked at this literature a lot. So if you look at the literature supporting the use, the scientific literature supporting the use of opioids, it's almost all funded by pharmaceutical companies. And almost all of the studies are seriously flawed. And the conclusions of those studies rarely are supported by the data that is included in those papers, if you really look at those critically. If you try to find a study that was not funded by Big Pharma, there's a very wonderful study that was published by the NIH that looked at patients with severe pain from osteoarthritis and compared the use of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs with the use of opioids and found it was what's called a meta-analysis, looking at a lot of studies, and they found no difference between nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and opioids in treating patients with severe pain from osteoarthritis. So that tells you something there as well. Now, to get to your question, so how do I approach my patients and talk to them about other options? My general discussion with my patients is I tell them that there are four ways that we can manage your pain. One is with operations and injections. One is with drugs. One is with physical medicine approaches. And one is with behavioral medicine approaches. And I think that the physical medicine and behavioral medicine approaches are often underutilized because they're not covered by payers. And the fact of the matter is that they're probably more useful than any of the other options we have. The other issue that impacts my patients enormously is the impact of untreated mental illness. You know, I have so many patients in my office who suffer from anxiety disorder, depression, bipolar disorder, you name it, who are there with pain. And oftentimes their pain, I think, is a consequence of their untreated mental illness or is at least amplified by their untreated mental illness. And it's just impossible for them to get the mental health care that they need.
Wow, that's a connection I hadn't even thought of. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Fanciullo.
Yeah, no, so I think that's it. I mean, I think I have a very organized approach, and it has to be a simple approach, four ways to manage your pain. Complementary and alternative treatments are options also, but they're not usually covered by payers. But I think that the behavioral medicine and the physical medicine approaches to managing people's pain, if we could apply behavioral and physical medicine approaches to managing pain and deal with untreated mental illness, I think the number of patients in our state and in our country with chronic pain would be dramatically reduced, 50% or more.
Wow. So behavioral approaches, again, Dr. Fanciullo, might mean, you know, physical therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic care. Go ahead.
Learning about pain, learning that if you have if all of a sudden your pain is a lot worse, you know, that it's not because a bone is broken. You're not doing what's called catastrophizing. Learning that you need to have what's called an internal locus of control. And so these, you know, big complicated terms for simple concepts. Most people, you know, they go to the doctors in Western cultures and they have strep throat and they want a shot of penicillin. So patients come to me with chronic pain, and they basically want a shot of penicillin. They put the they make it my responsibility as the doctor to solve their problem when I can't really solve the problem.
Okay, so
you have to teach them that the ball is really in their court, that they have this problem, that they have to figure out a way to cope with it, and that they can cope with it, and they can still find love in their life, and they can still find, you know, meaningful occupation in their life, despite the fact that they have this chronic pain.
So a cultural approach, a mind shift in a way, is needed by patients here in the U.S. Dr. Strang, I'll let you get the last word in here, whether you want to comment on just this overall idea that we have. As Dr. Fanciullo put it so well, you know, people want a shot of penicillin.
Well, he also mentioned that insurers were more willing to pay for a spinal fusion rather than physical therapy.
Right.
And I'm glad he brought up the topic of insurers. The largest insurer in our country is CMS, which is the federal government agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid. And currently they're in the practice of tying hospital reimbursement to patient satisfaction scores, particularly pain scores. And that has created a subtle but very real pressure to overprescribe. And it's something that I've seen as a practitioner in the emergency room. And finally, Senator Ayotte picked up on that a couple of months ago and wrote to Sylvia Burwell, who is the administrator of CMS, asking if she thought that this was a problem. Initially, the answer was no. Now they are looking into this. Anytime you tie financial reimbursement to a behavior, you are going to adversely affect that behavior. I think it's virtuous and wonderful to say we need to do a better job of controlling pain, but we need to de-link that from hospital reimbursement because we're going to make this problem harder to go away.
All right. Well, Dr. Strang, thank you very much for being here. That's Dr.
Thank
David
you.
Strang, again, chairman of the New Hampshire Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Advisory Council and an ER doctor. And Dr. Kolodny, it was great to have you, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's a senior scientist at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Dr. Fanciullo, thank you also for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Laura.
Dr. Gil Fanciullo, director of the Pain Management Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And last but not least, Representative Cindy Rosenwald, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.